It would seem there is a whole dimension to the question, what is a great butler, I have hitherto not properly considered. A great butler can only be, surely, one who can point to his years of service and say that he has applied his talents to serving a great gentleman, and through the latter, to serving humanity. I have no doubt been prompted to think along such lines by the small event that occurred an hour or so ago, which has, I admit, unsettled me somewhat. Having enjoyed a good morning's motoring in splendid weather, I had just crossed the border into Dorset. It was then I had become aware of a heated smell emanating from the car engine. The thought that I had done some damage to my employer's Ford was, of course, most alarming. My best course, I could see, was to look for a garage, or else a large house of a gentleman, where there would be a good chance I might find a chauffeur who could see what the matter was. I continued for another half a mile or so, the disturbing smell now growing stronger by the moment, until at last I came out onto a stretch of open road. Ahead, to my left, there loomed a tall Victorian house, with what was clearly a driveway converted from an old carriage track. I steered the Ford a little way up the drive, got out, and made my way to the back door of the house. Now, this was opened by a man who, upon my asking for the chauffeur of the house, replied cheerfully that I had hit the jackpot the first time. On hearing of my problem, the man, without hesitation, came out to the Ford and informed me, after barely a few seconds' inspection, "Water, Gov, you need some water in your radiator." He returned inside the house and, after a few moments, emerged again with a jug of water and a funnel. I had had, in the meantime, more opportunity to observe the house. I could see from its windows that at least half of it was dust-sheeted. I remarked on this to the man once he had finished with the radiator and closed the bonnet. "Shame, really," he said. "Truth is, the Colonel's trying to sell the place off." I could not help inquiring how many staff were employed there, and I suppose I was hardly surprised to be told there was only himself and a cook who came in each evening. He had been the Colonel's batman in the war, he explained. Then he regarded me carefully and said, "Now I've got it. You're one of them top-notch butlers." He then asked me where I was employed, and when I told him, he leant his head to one side with a quizzical look. "Darlington Hall," he said to himself. "Oh, hang on. You don't mean Darlington Hall? Lord Darlington's place?" It was Lord Darlington's residence until his death 3 years ago, I informed him. Now, the house is now the residence of Mr. John Faraday, an American gentleman. "Oh, you really must be top-notch working in a place like that. Can't be many like you left, eh?" Then his voice changed noticeably as he inquired, "You mean you actually used to work for that Lord Darlington?" "Oh, no. I am employed by Mr. John Faraday, the American gentleman who bought the house from the Darlington family." "Oh. So you wouldn't have known that Lord Darlington." "Oh, just that I wondered what he was like, what sort of bloke he was." I told the man that I would have to be on my way, and thanked him emphatically for his assistance. He had asked, "You mean you actually worked for that Lord Darlington?" And I had given an answer which could mean little other than that I had not. And it could simply be that a meaningless whim had suddenly overtaken me at that moment, but that is hardly a convincing way to account for such distinctly odd behaviour. Of course, there are many people these days who have a lot of foolish things to say about Lord Darlington, and it may be that you are under the impression I am somehow ashamed of my association with his lordship, and it is this that lies behind such conduct. Then let me make it clear that nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing could be less accurate than to suggest that I regret my association with such a gentleman. Indeed, you will appreciate that to have served his lordship at Darlington Hall during those years was to come as close to the hub of this world's wheel as one such as I could ever have dreamt. I gave 35 years' service to Lord Darlington. In looking back over my career thus far, my chief satisfaction derives from what I achieved over those years, and I am today nothing but proud and grateful to have been given such a privilege. I lodged last night in an inn named the Coach and Horses, a little way outside the town of Taunton, Somerset. The landlord led me up a timber stairway to a small room, rather bare but perfectly decent. Then, as the evening drew on, I began to feel a little restless in my room, and in the end decided to descend to the bar below. There were five or six customers, all gathered in a group around the bar. Acquiring a tankard of cider from the landlord, I seated myself at a table, intending to relax a little and collect my thoughts concerning the day. It soon became clear, however, that these local people were perturbed by my presence, feeling something of a need to show hospitality. Eventually, one raised his voice and said to me, "It seems you've let yourself in for a night upstairs here, sir." When I told him this was so, the speaker shook his head doubtfully and remarked, "You won't get much of a sleep up there, sir. Not unless you're fond of the sound of old Bob banging away down here right the way into the night, and then you'll get woken by his missus shouting at him right from the crack of dawn." Despite the landlord's protests, this caused loud laughter all round. "Is that indeed so?" I said. Now, I was struck by the thought that some sort of witty retort was required of me. Indeed, the local people were now observing a polite silence, awaiting my next remark. I thus searched my imagination and eventually declared, "A local variation on the cock crow, no doubt." At first, the silence continued, as though the local persons thought I intended to elaborate further. But then, noticing the mirthful expression on my face, they broke into a laugh, though in a somewhat bemused fashion. I had been rather pleased with my witticism when it had first come into my head, and I must confess I was slightly disappointed, because I have been devoting some time and effort over recent months to improving my skill in this very area. In any case, I am sorry to report that what the local people had themselves offered last night as a witticism of sorts, the prediction that I would not have a good night owing to disturbances from below, proved only too true. The landlord's wife did not actually shout, but one could hear her talking incessantly both late into the night and again from very early this morning. I was quite prepared to forgive the couple, however, for it was clear they were of diligent, hard-working habits, and the noise, I'm sure, was all attributable to this fact. Perhaps I might have done better to have lodged here, in this establishment where I now sit, enjoying a pleasant mid-morning cup of tea. It is situated on the High Street of Taunton, very close to the Market Square, a somewhat sunken building, its exterior characterized by heavy, dark timber beams. I am myself ensconced almost at the back wall, but even across the distance of this room I can see clearly out into the sunlit street, and am able to make out a signpost pointing out several nearby destinations. One of these destinations is the village of Mersden. Mersden, Somerset, was where the firm of Giffin and Co. was once situated, and it was to Mersden one was required to dispatch one's order for a supply of Giffin's dark candles of polish, to be flaked, mixed into wax, and applied by hand. For some time, Giffin's was undoubtedly the finest silver polish available, and it was only the appearance of new chemical substances on the market shortly before the war that caused demand for this impressive product to decline. As I remember, Giffin's appeared at the beginning of the '20s, and I am sure I am not alone in closely associating its emergence with that change of mood within our profession, that change which came to push the polishing of silver to the position of central importance it still by and large maintains today. As far as I was concerned, it was a simple enough matter. One used good polish, and one supervised closely. Giffin's was the polish ordered by all discerning butlers of the time, and if this product was used correctly, one had no fear of one's silver being second best to anybody's. I am glad to be able to recall numerous occasions when the silver at Darlington Hall had a pleasing impact upon observers. Perhaps the instance I recall with most satisfaction today concerned the night that Lord Halifax paid a visit to the house. As things turned out, that visit was the first of a whole series of such meetings between Lord Halifax and the German ambassador of that time, Herr Ribbentrop. But on that first night, Lord Halifax had arrived in a mood of great wariness. Herr Ribbentrop not being expected for a further hour or so, his lordship had suggested to his guest a tour of Darlington Hall. As I went about my business, all I could hear for some time was Lord Halifax continuing to express his doubts about the evening ahead. Then, at one point, I overheard Lord Halifax exclaiming, "My goodness, Darlington, the silver in this house is a delight." The truly satisfying corollary to this episode came 2 or 3 days later, when Lord Darlington remarked to me, "By the way, Stevens, Lord Halifax was jolly impressed with the silver the other night. Put him in quite a different frame of mind altogether." The state of the silver had made a small but significant contribution towards the easing of relations between Lord Halifax and Herr Ribbentrop. It is, of course, generally accepted today that Herr Ribbentrop was a trickster. It is, however, rather irksome to hear people talking today as though Lord Darlington was alone in believing Herr Ribbentrop an honourable gentleman and developing a working relationship with him. The truth is that Herr Ribbentrop was, throughout the 30s, a well-regarded figure, even a glamorous one, and many of the most distinguished ladies and gentlemen in this country were quite enamoured of him. The great hypocrisy of these persons would be instantly obvious to you were you to see just a few of their own guest lists from those days. And then again, you will hear these same persons talking as though Lord Darlington did something unusual in receiving hospitality from the Nazis on the several trips he made to Germany during those years. Anyone who implies that Lord Darlington was liaising covertly with a known enemy is just conveniently forgetting the true climate of those times. It needs to be said, too, what salacious nonsense it is to claim that Lord Darlington was anti-Semitic, or that he had close association with organizations like the British Union of Fascists. And the allegation that his lordship never allowed Jewish people to enter the house, or any Jewish staff to be employed, is utterly unfounded. Except, perhaps, in respect to one very minor episode in the 30s, which has been blown up out of all proportion. But perhaps one should not be looking back to the past so much. After all, I still have before me many more years of service I am required to give. And not only is Mr. Faraday a most excellent employer, he is an American gentleman to whom, surely, one has a special duty to show all that is best about service in England. It is essential, then, to keep one's attention focused on the present. For it has to be admitted, over these last few months, things have not been all they might be at Darlington Hall. Errors which have occurred over the last few months have been, naturally enough, injurious to one's self-respect. But then there is no reason to believe them to be the signs of anything more sinister than a staff shortage. If Miss Kenton were indeed to return to Darlington Hall, such little slips, I am sure, would become a thing of the past. Of course, one has to remember there is nothing stated specifically in Miss Kenton's letter, which, incidentally, I reread last night up in my room before putting out the light, to indicate unambiguously her desire to return to her former position. In fact, one has to accept the distinct possibility that one may have previously, perhaps through wishful thinking of a professional kind, exaggerated what evidence there was regarding such a desire on her part. For I must say, I was a little surprised last night at how difficult it was actually to point to any passage which clearly demonstrated her wish to return. But then again, it seems hardly worthwhile to speculate greatly on such matters now, when one knows one will, in all likelihood, be talking face to face with Miss Kenton within 48 hours.